Hi, this is Shujin Triple from Holy Crap the Vlogcast. When I'm not trying to stay indoors and away from the nuclear reactor in the sky, I'm having fun doing exactly what you're doing, listening to Inciting Incident.
It's Friday, and it's 7 p.m., which means it's time for the Inciting Incident podcast, supported by our patrons and available on Libsyn, Blog Talk Radio, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, Android, LiveJournal, Google Plus, The Hard Harry Show, News Radio, WHP 580, Rock and Emily's Bed Radios that are somehow appropriate for children that age, Most Tin Cans Connected with String, Tumblr, Snapchat, Zanga, LimeWire, WinMX, Napster. We'll have to spell it with two Y's there to escape Big Brother. The DCI, the Enchantment Under the Sea Dance, the Plate in Pete and Pete's Mother's Head, and any other podcast app that somehow escaped this list. And now, here's your host, Al Lehman.
Good evening. We are live from Baltimore. This is Inciting Incident number 57, and Jesse Dolemore's voice doesn't make you floaty and buttery. I don't know what will. It's fresh creamery butter. Is there anything more comforting?
You have a sick fixation on that adjective.
I really do. But you listen to that man's voice and tell me you don't want to use it.
That's fair. That's entirely fair.
Indeed. And, of course, if you haven't guessed already, joining me is my best friend and partner, Brian. Brian, welcome back.
I drove 2.5 hours for this.
Did you really?
No.
Okay.
No, thankfully.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're not that far from Baltimore. And joining us in person, as opposed to over Skype or whatever, in the all the other podcasts that we patronage who have had him this week, Andrew Torres of the Opening Arguments podcast. Yay. Welcome.
Well, thank you very much for having me. It's great to be here in person.
We kind of lucked out about the geography here for this weekend.
Yeah, no, this is fantastic.
All right. Well, I was looking at, I friended you because I had heard, you know, about the new podcast, and I had obviously heard your appearances on Thomas's podcast, which is, atheistically speaking, friend of the show, of course. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was looking you up because I wanted to interview you, and I said, you live in Baltimore? We should hang out. So that's how that happened.
It's like, we'll meet you, grab the beer, we'll meet you at the state line.
Pretty much. And
I'm always in for that deal.
Absolutely. And it was pretty simple as, hey, we're an hour and a half away, let's make this happen, and here you are. So thanks for hanging out with us. I'm so sorry. So for those of you who don't know, and if you don't patronize the same podcast that we do, which you should,
because all the cool kids do it.
Yep. Thomas Smith and our guest Andrew Torres have started a new podcast that is focused on law and sort of explaining some of the more confusing things about law to the layman, no pun intended. So
yes, pun intended. Oh. Every time you bring it up, it's pun intended.
It is not. It is not. Though coincidentally, we are now an LLC.
Oh, goody.
So,
good work.
We're professional. We're professional in the biggest air quotes I could possibly conjure.
When the LLC name involves the word lobster head, I don't know how professional it can possibly be. It's professional.
That's a Seamus joke.
Given that I organized the Scathing Atheist LLC, which is Puzzle in a Thunderstorm LLC, you're not even in the top five of, you know, ridiculous LLC names.
That's some bad hat, Harry.
I understood that reference. Because I've been following them long enough to understand that reference. Right. So for those who, like I said, may not patronize Gatheist Manifesto, Cogdus, Scathing Atheist, Atheistically Speaking, there seems to be a theme here. Andrew and Thomas recently started the Opening Arguments podcast and put out 8 episodes, which I consumed in one honeymoon. So
now that seems wrong.
You were on our honeymoon with us, Andrew.
See, I just did it within one day at work, but I work a 9-hour shift, so that filled up the span of time pretty nicely.
Well, we've got episode 9 is out now, mm-hmm. So... Yeah.
Listen to it today.
Awesome.
So without going into too much repetition for your sake and for those who do patronize those other shows, can you give us a little bit of your background and how you came to be in contact with Thomas Smith and being on his show?
Sure. So my background, I am a real-life lawyer. I'm a business lawyer, commercial litigator. Graduated from Harvard Law School in 97, been practicing ever since. Spent 19 years in big firms, and for the past year and a half, I've been out on my own. And one of the great things about being out on your own is I'm no longer overly concerned with, am I going to offend the managing partner or whatever? And so, there's a level of salesmanship and relating to your clients and mm-hmm. that sort of thing. So there is that. But I decided I've been an atheist for, 25 years, and I was really a passive sort of consumer in that community, right? I listened to all these podcasts that we were talking about, but I was never really out and active for a lot of reasons. So there was an episode of Atheistically Speaking. I don't even remember the episode, and I don't remember the issue, but I sent Thomas a little note, because there was a little legal wrinkle, and I sent him a message in one of the billion ways that you can contact Thomas that said, hey, just so you know, right, think about this little wrinkle in the law. And he wrote back and said, oh, that's really great. Thanks for the correction and everything else. And then after Scalia died, Thomas and I got together, and he had me on the show. I think it's 227. I could be wrong, but it's in sort of the 40 or 45 episodes ago on Atheistically Speaking, because Thomas's production schedule is crazy. As someone who works with him, he cranks things out.
He's extremely prolific.
Yeah, and with a day job. It's just it's unbelievable.
Yeah, his schedule must be crazy if he worked us in. That's ridiculous.
I gotta say, I'm pleased to sit down with you, if only because I get to check off another punch card on the real life lawyers that I have met.
Oh, nice.
Because you got a specialty that I've not encountered before. I have a cousin out in California who practices family law. Mm-hmm. Studied at UCLA. Go Bruins. And then we were talking before we started recording about gaming experiences and stuff. And when I was a student at Pitt, I was part of the club. And one of the best D&D dungeon masters that we had was, I can't remember if he was a graduate student or if he was actually an adjunct professor of international law.
Oh, very
at Pitt Law School.
Yeah. Having a family law mm-hmm. lawyer in your circle is incredibly useful, because I know that's one of the questions I get from friends and family all the time, and I have to say, I don't begin to know anything about that. And even when it's a situation where it's like, I would like to help you, I'm like, you mm-hmm. do not want me as your divorce lawyer. and I'm not going to go in and get my ass kicked by somebody who's been doing nothing but divorces for 20 years. No. When I fight battles, they're on my terms. The reason I went on Atheistically mm-hmm. Speaking the first time was to talk about the Supreme Court, and I know you've heard that episode, but I feel very, very strongly that Scalia is the most activist judge that we've had in recent Supreme Court history. You want to argue that Judge Taney or whatever was in 1827. I'm not equipped to make that argument, but I am equipped to defend the argument that there's no more activist judge than Scalia in the past 50 years, and that includes. That includes the Warren Court, that includes William Brennan. People that are sort of considered, you know, very, very activist judges. Scalia, like, honestly didn't care what the law was and how long established it was, as long as he could change it to meet his political ends. And, like, by any lawyer's definition, that's what activism means. So I got on, I ranted at Thomas for about an hour. It was like an hour and a half. And
he edited, I listened.
Yeah, he edited it way down. You probably had the Patreon feed, which
of course.
And from there, I did 4, 5, 6 atheistically speaking episodes, and finally, you know, Thomas and I got together one night, and we were like, you know, we should do this on a regular basis, because we were both having a lot of fun, and you know, I don't want to pat myself on the back, but there really isn't a show out there that is sort of taking contemporary legal questions and talking about it from, you know, at a layman's perspective. That actually was no pun intended.
Which, it must be because you got patreon.com/law.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, it's a good niche to fill, I think, because this is like the life skills conversation I have with my girlfriend about stuff they should be teaching you in schools. It's like, no, this is stuff that I think we as citizens need to know.
Yeah, and so, you know, I mean, we try and do that. Like, look, You both listened to the most recent episode, which is where we start to talk about abortion. And we're not shy about expressing our political opinions. That's out there. But, you know, I think even if you disagree with us, so for example, on the abortion episode, right, if you want to make the argument that philosophically a fetus is a person, right, go for it, right? And philosophically, like, I mean, I think pro-choice advocates, and I consider myself very strongly pro-choice, but I think we do ourselves a disservice if you say, you know, it's only people like reading Leviticus and like no. I mean, you can make a serious philosophical argument, but if you make the legal argument that a fetus is a person for purposes of the 14th Amendment, like, that's you're going to look like an idiot.
That's where the ground crumbles away beneath you. Yeah,
and you will have been led there by people who are deliberately trying to obfuscate things.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess where I would start with that is there are so many people involved in political discourse right now that, to put it mildly, have not been before and don't really know what they're talking about. But
my favorite subject.
Indeed. But at the same time, there are so many legal issues that affect us every day, and people like to talk about them, but it's almost like law is such a niche and it's so hard to get into that the common person doesn't know as much as, or don't really know anything, and make a lot of incorrect assumptions. Why are legal matters so hard to understand?
Yeah, I guess I feel two ways about that, right? And so one way is, on the one hand, the law has a specialized vocabulary, right? We were talking about this before we recorded that, you know,
Every longstanding,
every
longstanding tradition, whether it be, you know, in academics or in law or anything, has its own jargon. I mean, it's a trade language, basically.
Yeah. So, right. So, on the one hand, there is a very specialized vocabulary in the law.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I firmly believe it's something I'm sure you picked up because you've listened, you know, to Atheistically Speaking into the first 9 episodes of Opening Arguments. I think because of the way legal matters get dramatized in fictional media, that people tend to have this view of the law as this sort of arcane minefield of, like, oh, I must plead using the correct, you know, words from in Latin, and if I misspell the Latin subjunctive, then, you know, the court's going to dismiss my case. And you know, that's just not true at all. Like, there certainly was a period of time in which it was true, but in the 20th century, in the early 20th century, 1915, lawyers got together, really kind of amazing if you think about it. They got together and they abolished the forms of action, and they rewrote the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure to basically say you can write a complaint in, you know, pidgin English on the back of a napkin and turn it into a court, and, like, they have to take that seriously. And that it really marked the trend. I mean, you think about sort of where the United States was in 1915, right? You had the beginning of the rise of the socialist movement in this country. And I really think that there was this sort of public backlash that said, you know, I am employing a lawyer to go in and you know, draft an action in a sumpsit for the recovery of, and, you know, it just made no sense to people. Mm-hmm. And the lawyers kind of got together and said, well, why don't we get rid of some of the baggage that is making this not make sense? Mm-hmm. And so part of, so another one of my kind of pet hobby horses is telling people, right, the law isn't as scary as you think it is, and it definitely isn't this weird, you know, sort of game. Like, again, you know, we were talking about this right before the show began, but in one of our upcoming episodes, we're going to talk about, you know, the sovereign citizen and tax protester movement.
Right.
And that's entirely based on the idea that, like, if you cobble together a word here from a line here from an Illinois Supreme Court decision here from, and, like, you put it all together and you can create this, like, arcane world of, you know, if you invoke the magic spells,
right,
then, like, the courtroom doors open up. And, like, it's just not like that.
It seems to me like it's another one of those instances where it's not just that language in particular, with the talk about the magic spell invocation,
right,
has evolved and changed. It's that definitions in a legal sense are different from what we as lay people use. The only thing I can think to liken it to is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable? Well, are you asking a chef or are you asking a biologist?
And there are cases about that. Well, and the reason that there are cases about that is because you have to. So, for example, in contract law, mm-hmm. the primary question you ask is, what did the parties intend to effectuate when they signed this contract?
Right, right,
right. So if I sign a contract that says you get first pick of any of the fruit in my market,
mm-hmm.
then the court may have to figure out, is a tomato a fruit or a vegetable, right? And the reason is because the contract, most contracts, even ones that go into tremendous amount of detail, use phrases that have understanding between the parties. And so, again, kind of sticking with the theme, the first thing the court's going to ask is, what did these people really mean, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea that you could come in with this super clever technicality and be like, aha, judge, you see, a tomato genetically is a fruit, and so therefore I don't have to give them, that the judge is going to laugh you out of court with an argument like that. Like, I mean,
does the defense's case hold water?
Precisely.
Gotta work that in. So, I guess another place where we could really start before we get into the main topic today is, you know, at the beginning of every episode, you have to explain this is for entertainment purposes. You know, don't take law advice from a podcast.
Don't take law advice from a podcast.
Yes. And that, while that does include this podcast, though, if anyone's taking any advice from this podcast, I pity you.
What the hell is wrong with you? Yeah.
Indeed. But why do you have to say that? Like, first, why can't you get law advice from a podcast, and why do you have to say that?
Sure. You're actually the first person to ask. Everybody else just sort of assumes, like, oh, we're having a lawyer on the show. He's going to give some goofy disclaimer.
At the very least, I think it's understood that it's kind of a cover your ass kind of thing to say.
Yes. And I'll take that. But so there are really two reasons for it.
Mm-hmm.
The first is lawyers regulate themselves. There's a code of professional ethics, and that imposes restrictions on us that you might not expect. So, for example, there is a rule against, quote, ambulance chasing, right? Which is to say, if I know that, you know, you have a desperate need for a lawyer because you've just been in an accident, like, I can't track you down and forcibly solicit myself, right? Like, I have to generally solicit or wait for you to say, you know, hey, I'm looking for somebody. I mean, again, I don't do personal injury law, so it's never been an issue. But, you know, but we have restrictions on advertising. There's a great case. Everybody who's ever been to law school knows the King of Torts case. Mm. And a tort is just a civil wrong. But there was a guy who was holding himself out, and he said, you know, ran ads. Said, I'm Andrew Torres, King of Torts. Right? Again, not my shtick, but, you know, it was this guy's shtick. And he was actually brought up on disciplinary charges. Oh. And the reason law students know this is because this is what passes for humor in law school. The judge wrote, you know, unless the lawyer could prove a coronation, he may not hold himself out as the King of Torts. And that, again, I know it's sort of weak, but that's the best humor you'll get in a legal opinion. So the first thing is, the rules of professional conduct tell me to do that. The second thing is, if somebody is receiving and they're listening, and they think that that's created an attorney-client relationship, which it has not. Be clear on it. That creates obligations on me, right? Mm-hmm. So if I have, right, if we finish this and you hire me to do, you know, work for the for your newly formed LLC, which I'd be happy to do, by the way. If I become your lawyer, then that forms a confidential relationship. Mm-hmm. There are things that I can't disclose. I mean, I can't disclose anything without your permission at that point. So that's why I go through. So yes, there's a cover your ass, but there's also it I think helps, you know, the people who are listening understand, you know, sort of the nature of what you're getting out of all this. And, you know, and again, I should add, there's a third thing, which is mm-hmm. to say, I talk in general, you've probably heard me say this on Thomas's show, I view my approach to analyzing legal questions over the air as kind of the Bart Ehrman style of law, right? Like, I want to tell you what any average lawyer would agree, right? Left, right, center. Okay, that's right. He's maybe taking it a bit, you know, a bit far lefty than I would go. But nevertheless, like, I want, if anybody who's a lawyer listens to the podcast, I want them to walk away and be like, yeah, now he's saying exactly what I learned in law school. He's saying exactly what I've learned in my practice. Mm-hmm. And your specific circumstances, if you're like, oh, well, that seems really similar to that, it may seem similar to you, but from a legal perspective, it may be very, right, very different. And right. So I wouldn't want somebody to listen and say, oh, yeah, no, he said I could totally slander people, you know, left and right. You know, which is true as a general principle. Like, if there's a public figure involved, like, you can generally speaking slander the hell out of them. But again, like, that's not good advice to take.
No.
You know, so...
Okay,
so that's why I do it.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense to me, coming from my day job, which I don't know that I can really speak a lot of details, but I'm held to a lot of explicit standards because I work in purchasing.
Okay,
and there are a lot of specific standards as to, you know, determining fair and reasonable stuff, things as far as pricing goes or open competition.
Right,
and I'm held to those same standards. So yeah, no, this makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So what is it that you bought for the government, Brian? What are you hiding? That's how law works, right? I'm just checking.
Exactly.
Awesome.
We are not in the midst of a LARP of L.A. Noir, sir.
Oh, I was going for my cousin Vinny, but I'll tell you. To get into the main topic that we were going to before we get into
something else that's personal,
user questions and other things that we're going to talk about in the time that we have, because we're not on any specific time limit, unlike your podcast so far, which is not to put it down by any means, but just to say that on Inciting Incident, we can waste as much as your fucking time as you let us.
Cheers.
So.
Inciting Incident couldn't keep bringing you commentary, interviews, and fantastic guests without help from you, the patrons. You can support the podcast on a monthly basis at patreon.com/incitingincident, which gives you access to many great rewards, including a free t-shirt if you pledge $5 or more. You can also support the show by subscribing, rating, reviewing, and commenting. To contact them about ideas, guests, disagreements, fisticuffs, salmon slapping, rebel rousing, or just plain old tomfoolery, you can email them at incitingincidentpodcast@gmail.com. On Facebook, at facebook.com/incitingincidentpodcast. Or yell into a tin cup and hope it's connected to one of our aforementioned string networks. And now, back to the show.
One of the areas that we wanted to talk about because of our obsession with stand-up comedy, which we covered extensively, mm-hmm. is vulgarity, and which of course will eventually lead to the George Carlin case. But let's start with the basic idea of vulgarity, which has changed over the years from a legal perspective as well as a societal.
Yes.
So where does that stand generally now, and how has that changed since this case?
Okay, so good questions. Under the law, there's no such thing as vulgarity, right? Like that doesn't have a legal definition.
It's profanity, obscenity, and I think there's one other category.
Pornography.
Okay.
And obscenity.
Pop.
And so I would say this is another area in which I consider myself like a really happy optimist. Like, even surviving, you know, the tenure of Scalia on the court and the Rehnquist court and now the Roberts court, like, the Supreme Court's directionality in First Amendment cases has pretty much been entirely in favor of free speech. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so one of the things that I'll often tell people, right, the classic line of, you know, you can't shout fire in a crowded movie theater, right? Mm-hmm. Like, that's bullshit, okay? That case was not about shouting, it's called Schenck v. U.S., it was not about shouting fire in a movie theater, it was about distributing socialist literature. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court, about 100 years ago now, said that distributing socialist literature during World War I was the equivalent of running into a movie theater and shouting fire. And today, like, nobody, like, Alito wouldn't take that position, right? Like, there is no person on earth who would say, distributing socialist literature during a war is sort of the definition of political speech.
Right.
Right? And the idea that you would equate that to, well, this is obviously going to, you know, this is the equivalent of causing mass hysteria, mm-hmm. and direct physical harm is just sort of nonsense. So, you know, that case is overturned, right? That case was overturned by a 1969 case called Brandenburg versus Ohio. And so basically, like, the directionality of the court has been almost uniformly in favor of more free speech, which is a good thing, mm-hmm. I think. So when it comes to vulgarity, the questions that you want to ask yourself are, is this something that can be prohibited, right? Mm-hmm. What can be prohibited, outright banned, is obscenity, okay? What can be regulated, sort of a lesser category from obscenity, is pornography, okay? Pornography, very famously, has no legal definition. That is the, Potter Stewart, I know it when I see it, right? Yes. Which is one of the most unintentionally hilarious quotes in our book. But obscenity has a very, very specific definition. There's a 1973 case called Miller versus California, and it sets forth a three-part test, and something has to meet all three parts of the test to be considered obscenity. If it is considered obscenity, then the government may prohibit the production and sale of that obscene material. But there was a case that says you may not be criminalized for the mere possession of obscenity.
Oh, okay.
So most of your hardcore pornography cases, and again, these are all archaic by this point anyway. Mm. These are, you know, mailing magazines from the 1970s. but most of those cases that are obscenity cases are based on this this three-part test. And so here's what you have to meet in order to. So the first is, it has to appeal to the prurient interest, okay, which means it has to be sexual.
Mm.
Okay. It has to, yeah. The second is, it must do so in a patently offensive manner.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the third is, and this is one of the only examples, I've just said the court is moving towards more free speech. This actually relaxed the test a little bit. It used to be that the third prong was utterly without any redeeming social value. But it got relaxed in this Miller case in 1973 to the work taken as a whole lacks serious literary, artistic, scientific, social merit. And, again, as you guys will know, I'm not looking at a screen right now, so I'm paraphrasing this. Paraphrasing this a little bit. Sometimes, you know, I get the benefit of having my computer open, but here I'm doing this from memory with beer. But
which, to be fair, is a better way to do it.
It's still impressive.
So you have that. So basically, something has to fit each of those three prongs to be considered obscenity, and it must be. And in order to be considered obscenity, is the part at which it can be banned. And I should add, child pornography is essentially treated as a category all its own.
Mm-hmm.
We could talk about that, but it's its own area where mere possession, the Supreme Court has said it's perfectly valid to criminalize the mere possession as a way of de-incentivizing the production of it. And again, I agree mm-hmm. with that. So, it's interesting that all of those prongs on the Miller test are then, when you figure out what those terms mean, they are relative to local community standards, right? So what does it mean for something to be, you know, offensive to general standards of community decency? Well, again, that's not really a fixed point, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, as time has moved forward, right, that consideration has moved forward along with it. And so, I mean, when you look in the history of, right, obscenity, pornography, like, I mean, the things that were, you know, I mean, like, you see, you know, citations to D.H. Lawrence, right? Like, I mean, you see things that are assigned as reading in college literature classes,
right,
that were, you know, banned as pornographic. The first obscenity case that I know of involved a book of lithographs called Fanny Hill, and basically featured a number of pictures of a woman's backside, which, like, I'm pretty sure you can show that on, like, public television these days, right? Like, I mean, you know, it's a very nice picture of a lady's butt, but, like, you
know, time marches on.
Exactly.
Or as the people voting for Donald Trump would call it, the downfall of civilization and everything.
Jesus, these people.
So, you know, the point of vulgarity where we wanted to focus on, of course, was George Carlin and Pacifica versus the FCC, right, or FCC versus Pacifica, however it's said in the court documents. But, you know, this predates, of course, you know, being... that there was a time where we could go to jail for saying bad words, and Carlin famously did,
mm-hmm.
Going in the same paddy wagon as Lenny Bruce, right, one night for not showing his ID, at which point I believe Lenny Bruce called him an idiot. But, you know, in retrospect, it's kind of hilarious.
Yeah, one of the things he actually said to the cops was, "I don't believe in government-issued ID," and Lenny Bruce just called him, you know, a fucking moron.
Yeah. But how did... So we had this point where comedians could be arrested for just saying bad words, and this obviously came to a head when it got to the Supreme Court for the airing of the Seven Dirty Words.
Right.
So what was that process?
Yeah, so George Carlin had a routine that he called the Seven Dirty Words That You Can't mm-hmm. Say on Television. And there was a radio station, I believe in San Francisco, that...
The one that I think that's pertinent to the case was WBAI in New York.
Okay. Thanks.
Yeah.
Again,
I took notes ahead of time.
In front of, I have read the decision. So radio station.
You mean to step on your toes?
No, please do. I welcome all corrections. All right. And that's true. And it's funny because I think that shows sort of the difference between, right, like, as a lawyer, when I read the case, mm-hmm. right, I know that it's a radio station. Right? Like, beats the hell out of
me. Common denominator. Okay.
But, you know, so we read things mm-hmm. a little differently. So radio station, so George Carlin has this routine, puts it on the record. It's a well-known bit.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, again, perfectly legal for him to record those seven words,
mm-hmm.
right, and put them on a record and have it for sale. But this radio station, apparently in New York, broadcast the bit over the air,
mm-hmm.
And that was what ran afoul of the obscenity law. The Pacifica decision says, by the way, that those words are not per se obscene. And if you think about the test, right, it's post-Miller.
Mm-hmm.
No, like, just saying, like, one of the words is motherfucker, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think in Carlin's routine, he's like, that's the worst one, right? So let's think about that for a minute, right? There's no way using the word motherfucker turns something into obscenity just by, you know, the virtue of having that word in there. And the Supreme Court recognized that. But then they sort of divide it up into, if something is obscenity, it can be banned outright from all persons mm-hmm. and all places in all times. If not, then you go into the category of, and this is where almost all First Amendment regulation takes place today, and it's called time, place, and manner restrictions.
Mm.
And so, and again, I've defended this. I think the structure makes sense. I think there's certainly applications where you could argue, you know, one way or the other that it doesn't belong in this. But the way to think about a time, place, and manner restriction is, I have a right to deliver, you know, a lecture on, you know, the Hegelian dialectic. I do not have the right to deliver that from the loudspeaker mounted on a van through your neighborhood at 3 a.m. right? So, and ever, like, I've yet to meet the like craziest libertarian who's like, no, you know, unless you put up a gate in the community, you should be allowed to drive through and broadcast it.
I'll add you as my friend on Facebook. You'll meet a couple of them.
I know what you mean.
Please do. But seriously, like, I've yet to meet anybody who doesn't say, like, of course, right? Like, that's what we do. We're not restricting your right to freedom of speech to say maybe you can't do it from the, you know, speakers of a van at 3 a.m. Now, can you take that too far? I'm the first person to say, you know, when you have a designated free speech zone that's too small for the protest, like, mm-hmm. yes, you can take it too far. But by and large, it's a workable category. Mm-hmm. And so what Pacifica says is, because of the nature of the radio broadcast medium, we can have a time, place, and manner restriction on those words, not obscene, but not appropriate to broadcast at a time when children might be listening. Okay? And, I mean, this sort of gets into the question of, like, jurisprudence more generally, because, right, Pacifica's a 1970s case, right? Radio was edgy, cutting-edge technology back then. Like, you know, is what we're doing here, right, in recording a podcast, is this more like radio? Is this more like a phone call? Mm-hmm. Is this more like a newsletter? Like, you know, I don't know, and I don't, the Supreme Court has not issued a podcast case, right? Like,
right.
So what you have to do is you have to try and look through past precedent and mm-hmm. figure out, like, okay, well, you know, what does this most resemble, right? Like, on the one hand, you know, nobody is going to find this podcast by accident.
Right.
Like, you've got to search it out, mm-hmm. you know? And so, I mean, that's very, very different than the radio example of I can be, you know, just tuning the dial and all of a sudden, like, I let things linger on WBAI for a little too long and, you know, I'm quickly jamming the off button before little Susie hears it in the backseat.
I'm trying to remember because I read like a Cliff's Notes version of the case and the events mm-hmm. leading up to it. And if I think I remember the setup correctly, it happened. It was at 2 p.m. that this was played, and it was part of a segment. I think it was called Lunch Pail, that was going into the evolving uses of language and words specifically, and they closed out the segment with the 7 dirty
right.
words.
Yeah,
it was at a 2 p.m. I think in the afternoon.
And look, like, I swear a lot. we swear in my household, you know, in front of my 13-year-old son.
I'm sure he knows worse words.
but like I can't say it's irrational mm-hmm. to that. A significant chunk of the public would want to say, look, like, let's not have 2 p.m. over the public airwaves people saying motherfucker. Like, if they want to do it, like, you know, download, you know, subscribe to, you know, Inciting Incident and Scathing Atheist, and, you know, you'll get all the motherfucker you want. Like, you know.
I have to have that as our new slogan.
You'll get all the motherfucker
Inciting
you
Incident,
want.
All the motherfucker you want.
Now, okay, and again, I apologize because I just read this over the course of the day, and I'm trying to make sure I've got most of my information correct. So, from what I understand about how this case came to be in the first place, there was one complaint filed to the FCC over this, or one documented complaint. It was for a gentleman that was later revealed to be part of a morality in media organization, right. The anti-pornography people.
Right.
And part of Pacifica's defense of this original injunction from the FCC was that we have no record of any other complaints. You know, we did that. They did, and they even said they did the thing where before the segment aired, the on-air personality even warned the people that the last 15 minutes are going to be maybe offensive to your ears.
Right.
Please come back after that. So, I don't know. I guess there's a question of a degree of response leading up to this level of a case.
I think George Carlin did a subsequent bit about that, right?
Mm-hmm.
In post Pacifica, and I believe what he said was there was one complaint by a minister in Mississippi. I think it was. I seem to recall the punchline was that there are two knobs on the radio.
Yes,
but,
yes.
That the minister might not be comfortable with anything with two knobs on.
One of them turns the radio off, and the other changes the station.
There
tits jokes.
Nice.
Classy joint.
Nice.
All the motherfucker you want and tits. I approve of this message.
Pass the tits, will you, Bill?
But again, you know, that doesn't really change mm-hmm. sort of the level of analysis, which is,
right.
Is it, because what the Supreme Court is going to review is the FCC rule,
mm-hmm.
right? And so, again, sort of sticking with the kind of broad theme that I'm trying to lay out in terms of jurisprudence. If you say something is a constitutional right, mm-hmm. then what that means is that you're prevented from passing laws that abridge that, right? And there are plenty of areas where I think that's a really, really good thing, right? So, you know, for example, like the Obergefell decision, right? Like, we have said marriage is a fundamental right that must be protected equally. Mm-hmm. And so don't care where you are, and if 90% of the people in your state or locality want to ban gay marriage, like, too bad. That's what a free country is all mm-hmm. about, right? But when you're talking about so freedom of speech issues, I don't know that I'm willing to line up to say, like, that you know, being able to broadcast, you know, dirty words routine mm-hmm. on the air is something that reasonable people can't get together and be like, yeah, no, we just don't want this at 2 in the afternoon. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not me. Like, again, right. As I've said, I don't really care, but I can, I sort of tread lightly when it comes to, and this is, I mean, I find myself, right, I'm to the left of all my conservative friends and to the right of all my liberal friends. And this is an area where, like, I think it's fair to sort of ask, let's tread lightly before we say the Constitution prohibits you from doing this, right? Yeah. And that's kind of where I come out on that.
I think in the words of Patton Oswalt, the good summation of this opinion would just be, yeah. And this is actually something that interested me and was is personal to me. I mentioned to you both here and before we went on, I'm a graduate from the University of Pittsburgh, and I had the privilege of getting to work on the campus radio station. Mm-hmm. And the thing about that is it's not just like a, you know, a simple college shortwave type thing. It wasn't an internet broadcast thing. We had an actual FM band.
Oh, wow.
So we were actually held to FCC standards. And I remember this specifically. We had a guidebook for all on-air personalities. And would you believe that there are still 7 words? Would you believe there are now 2 lists of 7 words? Because we got one list that we could only say during the period of safe harbor, so between mm-hmm. 10 p.m. and 6 a.m., which I think this case kind of set the
right.
the standard for. And then there were 7 terms that you could not say on the air ever at all.
And would you like to say them on the air now?
I believe motherfucker was one of them. I think also cunt and cunt and any reference to blatant sexual acts like, you know, blowjob, handjob, etc.
And Puzzle and a Thunderstorm.
Puzzle and a Thunderstorm is definitely on the list. But it was interesting also to think about this, because we actually had meetings where we discussed sort of where we could tread as far as FCC regulations went with regards to song lyrics, because as the radio station, we had to edit our own lyrics.
Sure, sure.
And one of the questions was, okay, here's a song, here's the lyrics of the song, and the female singer actually mentions the word handjob in one of the verses. Now,
You and I apparently have very different tastes in music.
It was progressive. It was the progressive station, so it was literally everything that was not played on any other radio station. That was
so all the music I listened to.
Yeah. Al is my friend on Facebook, but so he knows I have a legendarily terrible taste in music.
What was it today? Rat?
Oh, yeah. No,
oh, baby.
I like 80s hair metal, unironically. So.
Cheers, my friend.
All right.
But the question of the moment became, now, is it okay for us to play this? And the answer will be yes if that term is not mentioned again at any other point in the lyrics. So there's a lot of interesting little backflips that you kind of have to do now, and it's a weird issue to skirt still.
Yeah, and you present, I think, sort of the best argument for the other side. Right? Mm-hmm. So, again, kind of getting back to, you know, the whole idea of opening arguments, a really good counter-argument to my people want to get together and not have motherfucker on their radio at 2 in the afternoon is that if you think about the time, right, mm-hmm. the 1970s, right, we didn't have alternative media internet. You did not have.
Right.
And so college radio stations, underground radio stations, were really, you know, a kind of critical source for dissenting voices, particularly like anti-war voices mm-hmm. in the early 1970s. And so, yes, I mean, like, I would agree with you that particularly 40 years ago, particularly at the time in which this came out, it's much more. It had a much greater chilling effect on kind of silencing communities and mm-hmm. shutting that down where you had right edgy, you know, a really obtrusive comedy that's designed to make you think about that. So number one, I think that's a really good argument mm-hmm. for the other side. Number two, I think you also point out something that I try and emphasize when we talk about legal shows, which is you can set a rule from the Supreme Court, mm-hmm. right? Or you can pass a law, but the primary way in which that law is going to be felt is going to be sort of at the implementation stages, right? What does the station manager tell you? What do they put in their book to show you before they go in there? Or, I mean, you might have heard me when I was talking about this on another podcast where, you know, when you talk about, you can set an abstract principle of, you know, labor and employment law, right? But what really matters is what does the HR supervisor tell your boss that they can or can't do, mm-hmm. right? What is the knowledge, like how is that conveyed to the people on the floor? Because the vast reality is that, you know, for most people, their experience is not going to be with the legal system, mm-hmm. right? Most of these cases, whatever it is, right? Saying something on the radio or being sexually harassed at work or whatever, most people don't sue. Mm-hmm. Lawsuits are really, really expensive and time-consuming and horrible, and I can say that. So I also try and think about, right, when I'm thinking in a political sense or in an abstract philosophical sense, like, how is this policy going to be put into practice, you know, in the office, mm-hmm. at the radio station?
No, completely irrelevant to the conversation, awesome. But you did gesticulate toward me and look at me when you said sexual harassment in the workplace, so I'm just curious if you're predicting something.
What do you know, sir?
But anyway, you know, George Carlin was, of course, you know, you were mentioning dissenting voices, and he was a dissenting voice in three different periods of his career, mm-hmm. and I think there aren't any as famous as the Seven Dirty Words. And the point that he made in the bit was one that he made more literally later, which was, these are only words, it's the context that matters.
Right.
And that, of course, seemed to go over the head of most people who were against this.
Well, and my how times have changed. I mean, you know, nuance and context is my slogan practically on this show. How often do we have to bring it up?
Yeah.
At least once more, as always.
Well, that's a good point. Again, if I want to go back to sort of sunny optimist mode.
Please right? do.
Yeah, one of the things that used to be a category of non-protected First Amendment speech, right? So, right, I've laid out kind of the general idea, mm-hmm. which is you ask, is this speech, right? And then if it is, by and large, it's protected other than, and then the restriction you would ask is this a valid time, place, and manner restriction? And if it fails both of those, like, your law is invalid. Like,
I find it interesting that this sort of match three criteria seems to come up in law a lot.
Yeah, it did for a long time, particularly in the 1980s. Sandra Day O'Connor was mm-hmm. the swing vote on the Supreme Court, and she was very, very fond of these balancing tests. Again, which is not to say every, and you know, the cases we're talking about are actually not O'Connor opinions, mm-hmm. But her legacy was, throughout the 1980s, she left behind a lot of these balancing test opinions. I really have changed my mind on that in law school. I tended to think, well, this is a great way to kind of, you know, balance everyone's interests, and mm-hmm. it seems really great. And as a practitioner, I've come to see the downside of that, which is when you say, we want to balance out, like, the interest of X, the interest of Y, the interest of Z. When I have a client, right, the client calls me up, and they do not want, I mean, maybe they listen to the podcast and, you know, enjoy long, involved, you know, lectures about the law. But, like, when they're paying,
right.
and paying me by the hour, they do not want an hour-long dissertation on that. They want to know, like, can I do this?
Right.
Right? And the problem with the balancing tests is you don't get that kind of hard, you know, black and white line of, no, you can't do this, yes, you can do this. I've got to say, well, you're probably okay, you know, and sort of put error bars on it.
God, it's like the classic sort of office work triangle. Do you want it done fast, good, right. or cheap?
Yeah, exactly. And no, and
pick two.
Is your podcast library short of comedy? If so, how about giving Atheist Apocalypse Podcast a listen? Come join our cast of jaded journalists, hopeless romantics, and aimless idealists as they deal with a perplexing government running amok in a post-apocalyptic world. You can find Atheist Apocalypse, a member of Fatecrafter Studios, on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Google Play, and Stitcher, or by going to atheistapocalypse.com. And while you're aimlessly surfing the internet, why not go over to fatecrafters.net and check out the other audio dramas offered by the studio, like You Are Here, our new sci-fi choose-your-own-adventure podcast, Fate Crafters Studios, bringing you the best in audio dramas since, well, just this year. But we swear, all of our shows are totes entertaining.
And from a business perspective, right, like the most important criterion that I found to any of my larger business clients is predictability, mm-hmm. right? Like they would rather the law be crappy, but I can tell them, no, you can't do that.
Right.
Than for me to be like, well, maybe you can do that. I don't know. Right. And the more other interests you bring in, the more you sort of have to, you know, give a qualified answer mm-hmm. as opposed to a yes or a no.
I can see why that's appealing, not just in a business sense, but I've getting into arguments with people on Facebook and other places. It seems like people want sort of a real black and white divide.
Yeah.
You know, can I do the thing? Can I not do the thing?
Well, and it's funny because I've gone much more, you know, in the balancing test in terms of having political arguments. Like, you know, one of the things that is crucial for any lawyer, for mm-hmm. any good debater, for, you know, that sort of thing is, you know, the adage of if you can't make your opponent's case better than they're making it, you're probably going to lose. Right? And like, I take that into every, mm-hmm. even when I'm doing, you know, a mundane, I had a property, you know, boundary dispute case, right? Mm-hmm. Like, even when I'm doing something mundane like that, I always sit down and ask myself, like, okay, what are they going to argue on the other mm-hmm. side? What's their best argument? And you sort of craft that so that you know what you're responding to. You know, you're going to do that. And I find that that has taken over a lot of, like, my political discussions. So, you know, I still come down. I like, there are still bedrock principles that are really important to me. There are still points of view that I think need to be ridiculed. Mm-hmm. But I do, you know, find myself much more saying, like, fair enough, I get this point, but I think it's outweighed by X, mm-hmm. as opposed to, like, no, I'm sorry, like, you don't get to make that argument.
But do you debate for a living? That's the big question. I'm sorry, that was my favorite thing ever. Just because, you know, we obviously weren't on the in-person basis that we are now, but when that was being discussed, I was just sitting going, really? Because, you know, my sister's the one who got me into skeptic podcasting, and it was at the weekend of our wedding where she says, yeah, I really enjoyed Dogma Debate, and I went, no! No! So, we're on your side.
There's not a side to be on. I would tell you, you know, David Smalley, if you're listening, I'm happy to come on the show.
If David Smalley's listening to us, like, what?
Yeah,
what
are you doing? I have no idea anymore.
I can't get No Illusions to return my email. David Smalley's listening to me? Like, no, no.
Self-deprecation on inciting incident.
It is true. And before we bring on the user question, there are two that I want to ask that I'm sure won't take up a great deal of time, so she can have her chance to nerd out here.
By the way, that's hilariously optimistic.
But when I say that, I mean it won't be tomorrow by the time we're done. So
again, still optimism.
All right, I'll keep time on this.
So first, of course, I have to ask, you know, you said you went to Harvard Law. Mm-hmm. I go to the University of Pennsylvania, right. So fellow Ivy League, of course. And the
state school!
No! We are not a state school!
No, I went to state school!
Yeah, people confuse us for Penn State all the time, and it pisses us off.
I know.
Anyway, so the joke about the Penn Law students is you know they're Penn Law because you never see them. So I have to ask, I hear words all the time like mandatory fails and things like that. Like, is law school really that strenuous? Or is that a myth made up to keep, like, the undesirables or noncommittals out?
So the last thing I would want to do is discourage people from going to law school, because the one thing this nation needs is more lawyers. I believe that very fervently. No, seriously, again, don't take legal or future professional advice from a podcast, but check... law school is unbelievably expensive. Mm. So think about, you know, make sure that that's absolutely what you want to do before heading off to law school. I would say, for me, I read really, really quickly, mm-hmm. right? And the primary thing at an Ivy League law school that you do. The teaching method is called the casebook method. And so what you are given is a giant thick textbook that is just past cases, and you just read cases. And there's a lecture that kind of draws the common thread throughout all these cases. But really what you're doing is reading the law, and you're starting, they deliberately do, I mean, it makes sense from a historical perspective, but it also makes sense to try and scare the shit out of you. So they start off with these, like, 1795 cases, you know, it has the, like, S that looks like an F, and you're like, and so Elizabeth Warren really famously did this actually to a friend of mine, whose on-screen name was a Sumpsit guy for a while. but so in the first day of her class, the first reading assignment, you had to read a bunch of cases. And the first case was in the old, we talked about the forms of action, right, which was the, like, crazy way you had to plead. And it, and the first line of the case is, this is an action in a Sumpsit, right? And then it goes through. And a Sumpsit is a way of, it's a special action of recovering your property. So, like, think about if you rented an apartment, right, and you are kicked out of the apartment and the landlord steals your television, right? Like, you could bring an action in a Sumpsit to recover the television. I think, I could be wrong in that because there hasn't been a Sumpsit for 150 years in this country. But but you had to read the case, and Elizabeth Warren would very famously, like, pick one sad first year, and she happened to pick my friend, Keith. If you're listening, Keith, this is a shout-out to you, buddy. And would point, Mr. Zaliga, what's a Sumpsit? And nobody, like, if you point at, I just explained what a Sumpsit is, right, but, like, if you point at me right now, if Elizabeth Warren were to walk in and point at me and be like, Mr. Torres, what's a Sumpsit? I would be like,
hi.
Because it's intimidating, right? Mm-hmm. So, okay. So there's a tiny, tiny bit of that, right? But what there really is just an unbelievable amount of reading. So, for me, I read super quickly, and I'm kind of a big dork. Everybody's pretty much gathered that from all my podcasting.
And the fact that you're on this show, right? So you got to be far in the dork category to hang up with us.
I liked law school. I had a lot of fun. I enjoyed it. It was a really good time.
And was Ted Cruz a diaper fetishist then, or was that something that, sorry, cognizant joke? The final question I'm going to ask before I let the aspiring lawyer ask a few is, you know, I've read several different places that my cousin Vinny is considered one of the best portrayals of actual legal procedure. I don't know how true that is, but even the articles I've read have said it's shown in law school, or at least certain parts of it are. So my question to you is, what's the best film portrayal of law you've ever seen, and what's the worst?
Okay, so here's my answer. The best on-screen portrayal of law are the first 5 or 6 seasons of Law and Order.
Okay. Oh, okay.
And in fact, we used to, independently in my evidence class, would watch Law and Order and then go in and ask questions back and forth to our professor, because they almost always got it right. And the way in which they created drama on this first couple of seasons, but 5 or 6, I mean, you know, was by having, by occasionally, by either having, inventing a fictitious law, or having within the bounds of the show, right, the DA say, I can't believe the judge, you know, kicked out this bit of evidence. And the other one would be like, well, you know, every once in a while, Judge so-and-so does something crazy, right? And so it was kind of a signal of, like, we understand, we just fucked up the rules of evidence here, but we have to do it to keep the show moving. So those early season Law and Order episodes were so good that literally, I remember I asked a question of my evidence professor one day. I was like, well, you know, this was, you know, ruled inadmissible or whatever. And he looked at me and said, well, it's possible that they just got that wrong on the show. It was a little bit of a deflating moment. But so those were good. And the best part, by the way, the part that is the most realistic, that has nothing to do with the actual courtroom procedure, was he just died recently. The DA Adam Schiff, I forget the actor who portrayed him, who was fantastic. But his tagline was "Make the deal," right? Yes. Like, and I have friends who are prosecutors who've spent stints as prosecutors, and that is overwhelmingly the case, right? Like 95% of all criminal cases are pled out. Mm-hmm. And you always saw like that perspective on the show that, you know, got kind of lost in the later episodes. So early Law and Order, best illustration of law on the screen. Worst portrayal of law in me that I've ever seen is the John Grisham adaptation of The Firm. Which I have not made it all the way through because the entire dilemma of The Firm can be solved in about 3 seconds, right? Like, so The Firm starts off and it features a guy, maybe Harvard, I don't know, Ivy League law student who is recruited to big Southern law firm and wined and dined and brought in. And all of that shit is true, right? That happens. Comes in, realizes that the firm's primary client is, I think, like a mafia front, or is some sort of shady criminal organization. And then the movie focuses on his dilemma between needing to represent his client, needing to do what's right, and if I tell somebody that, like, I represent this shady client, then I'm going to be disbarred or whatever. And, like, I don't know how they resolve it in the film, but, like, the way you resolve that in real life is you tell on the fucking client. Because the law, and I say this to my clients all the time, like, you have, if you tell, you hire me, I am your lawyer, you can tell me you were the second shooter on the grassy knoll who killed Kennedy. And if I breathe a word of that, it, you know, at home, if I go home and be like, hey, honey, you'll never hear, guess what I heard? Like, you can have me disbarred, tarred, feathered, arrested, run out of town.
Right.
Okay. I have to keep that in the vault for all eternity. Okay. But if you say to me, like, hey, you know, this is how I knocked off that 7-Eleven last week, and this is how I'm going to knock off the 7-Eleven tomorrow,
right,
I'm required to turn you in, because of course I'm required to turn you in, because otherwise you use your lawyer as an accomplice to criminal behavior, right? So the entire setup of The Firm, I was just like sitting there looking for a pillow that I could throttle or something, because it was just, it just pissed me off.
I feel like I have to ask on behalf of a friend of mine, what's your opinion about Judge Dredd?
Which one?
He is the law.
So having not seen the remake.
You should, it's actually really good.
All right, I will check it out. I recommended, when Thomas and I were picking clips for opening arguments, which I'm pretty proud of our clips. We've got some that we're going to rotate in or whatever.
It's a great intro.
And one of the ones, Thomas produces all of that, all of the music, does all of the stuff. Yeah, he's great. I could not have gotten more fortunate with hooking up with Thomas. One of the clips I wanted was Stallone saying, I am the law. It was so great.
I think you might be able to swap out the closer for that one, although I really appreciate the liar, liar, stop breaking the law, asshole!
Thomas totally sprung that on me without any advance warning, which is part of why I think it's great. And like the fact that that's now the sign out after our main segment every time is just, you know, keeps you grounded. And I should mention, and my mom and my Aunt Donna are going to listen to this podcast as well.
They are?
Oh, yeah.
I'm so sorry.
Hello, ladies.
I tried, the one thing I did warn them on Facebook when I shared the Scathing Atheist link of, maybe you should give this show a pass. No, they're my family's super supportive. I kind of like having that little bit in it. It just, you know, keeps everyone grounded, reminds everyone, like, we're having fun here, like, you know. And again, it's part of what we're trying to do with the show, right? Like, it's, I don't think there's anything out there that is doing what we're doing, and we're trying to have fun doing it, so.
Well, I'm so glad that you are. Now, we're going to bring on my new wife, Catherine Goodliff.
Yeah.
Come over here.
By the way, I extended congratulations before we started taping, but now that we're on air, congratulations to the two of you.
Thank you.
Much happiness.
Thank you.
Yes, cheers on the drink you don't have.
She could reach over and get it.
But she's not going to.
No.
Catherine, you are an aspiring civil defense lawyer,
here
we have a lawyer. So what would you like to ask our friend Andrew here?
Well, okay, before I do, I just need to get this out of the way to cover myself. I am still a paralegal student. I'm going for my associate's degree as a paralegal at my local community college. I am not a practicing paralegal yet. I in no way represent Mr. Torres. None of the following is regarded as legal advice. If you have any legal advice, I advise you ask your attorneys. Thank you.
She's lying.
Hey.
I just want to point out, I didn't talk. I didn't ask her to say that. I didn't confirm with her beforehand, so... You've got the disclaimer part down pat. So.
Well, I just learned a few days ago that paralegals can be pinned for unauthorized practice of law, so I really want to keep away from that before I even start. Okay, my first question is a bit of a heavy hitter, but I'm serious. I just learned about this in business law today, but regarding the language used in the Establishment Clause and RFRA, specifically the portion of the Establishment Clause that states quite clearly the government is prohibited from passing any laws that promote any religious of any kind. Would RFRA, technically speaking, in your opinion only, be considered unconstitutional?
No. Okay. And so... in terms of the Establishment Clause, right, the Establishment Clause is governed by the Lemon Test, which is another one of these delightful three-part tests that basically says if your bill, if your law would does not have a secular purpose, if it excessively entangles government with religion, or if it prefers one religious branch to another, It must pass all three of those in order to be a valid law. Otherwise, you have an Establishment Clause claim. What RFRA does, I actually just did a little bit of this with Noah on The Scathing Atheist. RFRA is not concerned with the Establishment Clause at all. RFRA is concerned with the Free Exercise Clause. And so what RFRA does is say, from a statutory perspective, that Congress intends to write into every law going forward an implicit exception for that the law does not substantially burden the individual's exercise of their sincerely held religious beliefs. And in my view, the primary problems with RFRA are that original language from the federal RFRA, particularly at the state level, has been expanded and sort of pushed to the boundaries where, for example, we now say a corporation that sells, you know, cheap crafting crap has a religious belief, right, which is just, that's inexplicable to me, right? Like, how can a corporation have engaged in religious practices, right? And that the notion of what constitutes the exercise of any of their religious beliefs has been expanded from sort of what we would otherwise think of as core religious tenets, right? So the early, so RFRA stands for Religious Freedom Restoration Act. The idea is that it's restoring the 1970s era interpretation of the Free Exercise Clause, which said things like, hey, if you're a business and you give your workers off on Sunday and I'm a Seventh-day Adventist, you have to give me off on Saturday instead, right? Okay. And we could debate that politically, right? Like, I'm happy to entertain arguments either way or whatever. That kind of accommodation, like, if you think about that as a core religious belief, like, yes, Seventh-day Adventists think, like, that working on a Saturday is, you know, the biggest, I mean, that's the name of their entire religion, right? Like, I mean, that's the biggest abomination that you can commit, right? As opposed to, I don't want to touch a packet of contraceptives because I'm a Baptist, right? Like, I don't even know where that connection is. And, you know, one of the things I said on Scathing was, if you look at the history of anti-abortion legislation and the anti-abortion movement in this country, it was not a Protestant movement until the late 1970s, early 1980s.
It was a Catholic movement.
Absolutely. It's been a long-standing Catholic movement. But in 1965, when you were talking about passing laws, the people who were allied with pro-choice were often your Baptists and, you know, the people that are out there claiming, you know, that the third commandment right now is thou shalt not have an abortion.
so it's the seventh, everybody.
Right, right. So the point on that is that that what the state RFRA actions, state RFRA statutes have done is codify things like exercise of belief, like Indiana's law, for example, says this, comma, whether that belief is central or, you know what I mean? So really, all you have to do now is claim that it is a religious belief. And if, and this is a callback to your last episode, the original, those 1970s era cases, what they looked at was not matching up the belief with your scripture, but they said, is that belief sincerely held, right? And that's why the phrase sincerely held religious belief is associated with RFRA, even though those words are not in the statute at all, right? They do not appear anywhere in the RFRA laws, but essentially what the Supreme Court has said is that for purposes of free exercise, look, we don't want to get into trying to figure out, like, what do Mormons believe? Like, you know, that's not a job for Supreme Court justice. That's a proposition with which I wholly agree. and so all we're going to ask is, do you appear to be sincere in your advocacy of these beliefs? And if you are, and it fits the statute, congratulations, you get your exception. And so my concern about RFRA is just the massive expansion, both in terms of what constitutes a substantial burden and in terms of whether that exercise is... in any way, like, is tangential to your beliefs, is central to whatever, that, like, I think both of those sort of need to be scaled back. I think the state RFRA acts are constitutional, right? We had a case that determined that the federal portion of the Federal RFRA Act is constitutional. And, right, I think it is. Even though, obviously, right, I think the Hobby Lobby decision is an abomination.
Yeah,
right?
It's problematic as hell, but it's constitutional.
Yeah, And the nice thing, well, it's both a nice thing and an unfortunate thing. Like, the nice thing is when you're talking about legislation, right, like, you can always repeal legislation. The unfortunate part about that is the Congress hasn't been able to do anything for 6 years. So, yeah. You know, saying there's legislative action is sort of a pie in the sky dream at this point. But I think that, again... sort of sunny optimism is coming out. I think that logjam is going to get broke. It has to be. Like, you can't run a country where, like, you can't legislate stuff. So. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Is that a good answer sufficient?
Oh, yes, definitely. My next question kind of goes into that, and I'm about to name drop. This one I heard on the Scathing Atheist tonight. Hello, Noah. Hello, Noah. Hello, Heath. You owe me.
You better say hello to Eli. He's a patron.
Well,
he's busy fucking his way across Europe right now.
Exactly.
No, he's back. They're back in town.
Well, then, in that
case... So he better be listening.
Well, then, in that case, since he's listening... Hi, Eli. Congratulations. Anyway.
He messaged me on our wedding day. I just want to say that. He is awesome.
He's good people.
I say this with no offense to anyone in the room or to my podcasting partner or to anyone else. Eli may be the nicest person I have ever met, period. I mean, not just in terms of getting into podcasting in the atheist community. Like, Eli is a fantastic human being. Mm-hmm. We love you, Eli.
We take no offense to that whatsoever. If we're held right under Eli Bosnick, I consider that a compliment.
This story we had heard, we had actually just gotten off the exit, but they didn't specify exactly what company the man worked for, but he had vandalized his place of business using oil to, you know, anoint the building to keep it away from, and I can't believe I'm saying this, dark Satan magic. Now, again, something else I just learned today, the free exercise clause, the government is not able to infringe on any religious beliefs, whatever they may be, unless it affects public welfare. And I noticed that he tried to sue for wrongful termination under...
Because that's what shit can.
Sincerely held religious beliefs, however, that violates that clause. So, although I understand, you know, sincerely held religious beliefs, air quotes, since everyone at home can't see it, since when did that become a solid argument for... you know, anything, and
rolling around in oil in your workplace.
Yeah, and how does
I'm gonna come I'm gonna come in tomorrow and just draw a big alchemy circle on the floor of my cubicle,
and we're just gonna, you know, do that for fun because we're a company now,
so. And to expand on my question, in that case, what would law would trumpet, state or federal?
Okay, let me not answer the state or federal part first.
Okay.
The third part of RFRA that we didn't talk about is So RFRA applies when you have a neutral law of general applicability. And then somebody says, no, no, this neutral law is infringing upon my ability to practice my sincerely held religious beliefs. And that's what we just walked through. But there's still one more clause that gives the government an out, right? Which is to say that if the law, as applied to you, the religious applicant, is the narrowest tailored, right, is the language in the statute is the least restrictive means necessary to achieve the objective, then the government still wins, then the law applies to you.
Okay.
And that actually dates back to the first example that I know of that coming into play is a taxation case. It's Lee versus United States from 1982, in which the Amish said, we don't want to pay Social Security taxes because we think it's wrong for government to be taking care of old people. Like, the way to take care of old people is to raise barns or something. I don't fully know how it... And so the Supreme Court said, look, we're not going to get into whether paying taxes violates the Amish beliefs, but even if it does... like, too fucking bad. Like, we've got to collect taxes, and there's no other way to do this than to collect taxes, so this is the least restrictive means, so you don't get an exception, pay your taxes.
Mm-hmm.
So
we all know the way to take care of old people is to put them on a sheet of ice and send them out in the ocean. That's the best way.
Yeah, sincerely held Viking beliefs.
But honestly, I think this country would be a lot better if we adopted some more sincerely held Viking beliefs. More mead!
More four!
Oh,
so I suspect, again, I should say my knowledge of the oil case comes from listening to Scathing today.
hey, us so, too! We're on lead! We're on triple downs or right. Something! Yay!
Usually I would want to, you know, dig in, read the complaint, figure out the facts. Not that I have any doubt that those guys portrayed it accurately. If that's the case, then I think it wouldn't be hard for a judge to say the least restrictive means for us to make sure that our places of employment are not covered with oil is to continue to abide by the basic standards of general applicability that apply to everybody. And I'm really, really sorry that infringes on your sincerely held religious mm-hmm. beliefs, but it's kind of important that we not have oil all over our office. And the problem is, right, even at the Supreme Court level, like, what does least restrictive means mean? Like, I don't know, right? And if you came into my law office and asked me, you know, is this the least restrictive means? I don't know what I could tell you, right? Like, I mean, I could talk to you a little bit about, it's part of why, right, I think RFRA, the way it's going, is untenable. I hope that there are appropriate legislative solutions. I talked a little bit about that on the Scathing broadcast. But I think we're starting to get to a point where the average Christian person, mainstream voter, is looking at this going, this seems like it's kind of gotten out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
So,
good.
Well, I'm going to give you one of our patron rewards for meeting up with us in person, and this will include all of us. And then, of course, I'll ask you a question that reverses it a little bit. I'm going to start with Brian.
Mm-hmm.
Brian, if you could replace any television or movie lawyer with Andrew Torres, and you have the option of changing the ending, which would it be?
As much as it would shame me to lose this character, I would let Andrew replace the advanced country hyper chicken from Futurama.
Oh, good one, good one.
In which episode and which case?
It'd be any episode where he appears. I'd have him in that one episode where he's in jail for incompetence, and you'll win your incompetence hearing, my friend.
All right. Catherine, same question.
Oh, goodness, that's a tough one. Honestly, it's kind of a tie between, heavens, I can't remember his name. The one from The Simpsons, I can't remember his name.
You mean Lionel Hutz, attorney at law?
Yes, either him or Elle Woods, just to see how strange where you figure out that the one witness is gay, and I mean the whole ending would have to change anyway because a permit Look, I know you did it. It's too obvious. You're too nervous. I don't even need to know what a perm is. You're guilty, and I already know it, so let's just get this out of the way.
Look, that one's wearing a belt. That's Hollywood for you.
Before you hear my answer, there is a twist to the ending.
Oh, dear.
I would replace the lawyer in Jurassic Park with you, but I would have you punch the T-Rex in the face and go, no! No! And then you take the T-Rex and have it go to America and tear up Riff Raff. So there's my Jurassic Park story. So my question for you is, if you could replace any lawyer in any TV or movie, which would it be and what ending would you change? And you can't use the firm. You already used that one.
All right. Then I am going to take a little known Judd Nelson vehicle from 1987 called From the Hip, in which he plays a crazy sort of young lawyer. The movie is terrible in all of its courtroom antics, but I have such a huge soft spot for Judd Nelson. There's a large and totally irrelevant sequence in which he hides a dildo in the vibrator in the opposing counsel's trial bag results in the opposing counsel pulling it out, putting it on the table. It's vibrating across the table, making this loud, humming noise. And the lawyer looks up and says, "Your Honor," to try and get it. And the judge, an elderly African American woman, looks over and says, "Don't look at me, it ain't mine." I've never quite had a trial scene like that. And I think I'd like to be in that courtroom. So.
And as a postscript to that, we'll have Astrid be the owner of the vibrator, because of course she would. Yeah. So, Andrew, we really want to thank you for coming on and hanging out with us. If people want to hear your podcast or any of the many appearances you've done recently, how should they find it?
So, if you go to iTunes and look up Opening Arguments, you will be directed there. You can find us on Facebook is Opening Arguments, on Twitter is Open Args, and the website is openargs.com, OPENARGS. But we're not hard to find. And I hope you will give the show a listen.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for having me on. This has been a lot of fun, and I'm sure it's going to continue after we shut off the recording.
Of course it is. Steve Cully's coming in. So, we definitely want to thank our top patrons who will get first access to this, our Hall of Fame patrons, as Thomas puts it. We have Greg T. Reich, who has doubled his patronage
for
the privilege of driving Uncle Yo to my wedding.
Thanks, Greg.
We have, of course, your friend Sean Meehan.
Yep.
We have Eliza Baker, Rob Daniels, and everybody else who I don't have the screen in front of me. Everybody who contributes to our Patreon, which is not as cool as having patreon.com/law, but it's good enough, and you get good prizes. It's monthly, not per episode. I patronize patreon.com/law, so should you, but you should also patronize us. Just saying. And I can now say this for the first time. Inciting Incident is a property of It's a Shameful Thing Lobster Head, LLC, and yes, that's a real thing.
Woo-hoo!
Registered September 2016.
Awesome.
We want to thank everybody tuning in. We want to thank Andrew Torres for coming on, and Thomas Smith, friend of the show, for starting this podcast with him, and for everything else. I lost what I was going to say there. So
evidently.
Thank you for coming on. Thank you, everybody, for listening. This has been a lot of fun.
Driving up toward Green Bay, then east, the sun's in the rearview mirror. We both had some pretty tough weeks, white knuckles try to steer. A few more miles, there's no telling what we'll find. All we gotta do is take a little time. We all gotta find our own ways to to love and hope and breathe again. For some that just happens to be on the shores of Lake Michigan. You can't explain the way a city grips your mind. All we gotta do is take a little time for you and me and the moon and Lake Michigan. Waves flow right in and hair rocks and vanish from our sight. Kinda like those troubles that wash away quicker in the moonlight. This crazy old world's got no reason or rhyme. All we gotta do is take a little time for you and me and the moon and Lake Michigan. To no chance for all that stormy weather, no. It appears conditions won't get much better for you and me and the moon and Lake Michigan. Sometimes this old world seems much worse than it should be. A couple days later, you're sitting and thinking how lovely. I won't question the scope or design. All I gotta do is take a little time for you and me. Michigan.